clothed again with their old cloaks, and their bright helms with their tattered hoods. And one by one they walked behind Thorin, a line of little lights in the darkness that halted often, listening in fear once more for any rumour of the dragon's coming. Though all the old adornments were long moulded or destroyed, and though all was befouled and blasted with the comings and goings of the monster, Thorin knew every passage and every turn. They climbed long stairs, and turned and went down wide echoing ways, and turned again, and climbed yet more stairs, and yet more stairs again. These were smooth, cut out of the living rock, broad and fair, and up, up the dwarves went, and they met no sign of any living thing, only furtive shadows that fled from the approach of their torches fluttering in the draughts. The steps were not made, all the same, for hobbit legs, and Bilbo was just feeling that he could go on no longer, when suddenly the roof sprang high and far beyond the reach of their torchlight. A white glimmer could be seen coming through some opening far above, and the air smelt sweeter. Before them light came dimly through great doors that hung twisted on their hinges and half-burnt.
"This is the great chamber of Thror," said Thorin. "The hall of feasting and of council. Not far off now is the front gate."
They passed through the ruined chamber. Tables were rotting there. Chairs and benches were lying there overturned, charred and decaying. Skulls and bones were upon the floor, among flagons and bowls and broken drinking horns and dust. As they came through yet more doors at the further end, a sound of water fell upon their ears, and the grey light grew suddenly more full.
"There is the birth of the running river," said Thorin. "From here it hastens to the gate. Let us follow it."
Out of a dark opening in a wall of rock, there issued a boiling water, and it flowed swirling in a narrow channel, carved and made straight and deep by the cunning of ancient hands. Beside it ran a stone-paved road, wide enough for many men abreast. Swiftly along this they ran, and round a wide-sweeping turn, and behold, before them stood the broad light of day. In front there rose a tall arch, still showing the fragments of old carven work within, worn and splintered and blackened though it was. A misty sun sent its pale light between the arms of the mountain, and beams of gold fell on the pavements at the threshold. A whirl of bats, frightened from slumber by their smoking torches, flooded over them. As they sprang forward, their feet slithered on stones rubbed smooth and slimed by the passing of the dragon. Now before them, the water fell noisily outward and foamed down towards the valley. They flung their pale torches to the ground and stood gazing out with dazzled eyes. They were come to the front gate and were looking out upon Dale.
"Well," said Bilbo, "I never expected to be looking out of this door, and I never expected to be so pleased to see the sun again, and to feel the wind on my face. But oh, this wind is cold."
It was. A bitter easterly breeze blew with a threat of oncoming winter. It swirled over and round the arms of the mountain into the valley, and sighed among the rocks. After their long time in the stewing depths of the dragon-haunted caverns, they shivered in the sun. Suddenly Bilbo realized that he was not only tired, but also very hungry indeed.
"It seems to be late morning," he said, "and so I suppose it's more or less breakfast time, if there's any breakfast to have. But I don't feel that Smaug's front doorstep is the safest place for a meal. Do let's go somewhere where we can sit quiet for a bit."
"Quite right," said Balin. "And I think I know which way we should go. We ought to make for the old lookout post at the southwest corner of the mountain."
"How far is that?" asked the hobbit.
5 hours' march, I should think. It will be rough going. The road from the gate along the left edge of the stream seems all broken up. But look down there.
The river loops suddenly east across Dale in front of the ruined town.
At that point there was once a bridge, leading to steep stairs that climbed up the right bank, and so to a road running towards Ravenhill. There is, or was, a path that left the road and climbed up to the post. A hard climb, too, even if the old steps are still there.
Dear me, grumbled the hobbit. More walking and more climbing without breakfast. I wonder how many breakfasts and other meals we've missed inside that nasty, clockless, timeless hole. As a matter of fact, two nights and the day between had gone by, and not altogether without food, since the dragon smashed the magic door. But Bilbo had quite lost count, and it might have been one night or a week of nights for all he could tell.
"Come, come," said Thorin, laughing. His spirits had begun to rise again, and he rattled the precious stones in his pockets. "Don't call my place a nasty hole. You wait till it's been cleaned and redecorated."
"That won't be till Smaug's dead," said Bilbo glumly. "In the meantime, where is he? I would give a good breakfast to know. I hope he's not up on the mountain looking down at us." That idea disturbed the dwarves mightily, and they quickly decided that Bilbo and Balin were right.
"We must move away from here," said Dori. "I feel as if his eyes were on the back of my head."
"It's a cold, lonesome place," said Bomba. "There may be drink, but I see no sign of food. A dragon would always be hungry in such parts."
"Come on, come on," cried the others. "Let us follow Balin's path."
Under the rocky wall to the right there was no path, so on they trudged among the stones on the left side of the river, and the emptiness and desolation soon sobered even Thorin again. The bridge that Balin had spoken of they found long fallen, and most of its stones were now only boulders in the shallow, noisy stream. But they forded the water without much difficulty, and found the ancient steps, and climbed the high bank. After going a short way, they struck the old road, and before long came to a deep dell sheltered among the rocks. There they rested for a while, and had such a breakfast as they could, chiefly cram and water. If you want to know what cram is, I can only say that I don't know the recipe, but it is biscuitish, keeps good indefinitely, is supposed to be sustaining, and is certainly not entertaining, being in fact very uninteresting, except as a chewing exercise. It was made by the lake men for long journeys. After that they went on again, and now the road struck westwards and left the river, and the great shoulder of the south-pointing mountain spur drew ever nearer. At length they reached the hill path. It scrambled steeply up, and they plodded slowly, one behind the other, till at last, in the late afternoon, they came to the top of the ridge and saw the wintry sun going downwards to the west. Here they found a flat place without a wall on three sides, but backed to the north by a rocky face in which there was an opening like a door. From that door there was a wide view east and south and west.
"Here," said Balin, "in the old days we used always to keep watchmen, and that door behind leads into a rock-hewn chamber that was made here as a guardroom. There were several places like it round the mountain, but there seemed small need for watching in the days of our prosperity, and the guards were made over-comfortable, perhaps. Otherwise we might have had longer warnings of the coming of the dragon, and things might have been different. Still, here we can now lie hid and sheltered for a while, and can see much without being seen."
"Not much use, if we've been seen coming here," said Dori, who was always looking up towards the mountain's peak, as if he expected to see Smaug perched there like a bird on a steeple.
"We must take our chance of that," said Thorin. "We can go no further today." "Here, here," cried Bilbo, and flung himself on the ground. In the rock chamber there would have been room for 100, and there was a small chamber further in, more removed from the cold outside. It was quite deserted. Not even wild animals seemed to have used it in all the days of Smaug's dominion. There they laid their burdens, and some threw themselves down at once and slept. But the others sat near the outer door and discussed their plans. In all their talk they came perpetually back to one thing. Where was Smaug? They looked west, and there was nothing. And east, and there was nothing. And in the south there was no sign of the dragon, but there was a gathering of very many birds. At that they gazed and wondered. But they were no nearer understanding it when the first cold stars came out. Chapter 14. Fire and Water. Now, if you wish, like the dwarves, to hear news of Smaug, you must go back again to the evening when he smashed the door and flew off in rage 2 days before. The men of the lake town Esgaroth were mostly indoors, for the breeze was from the black east and chill, but a few were walking on the quays and watching, as they were fond of doing, the stars shine out from the smooth patches of the lake as they opened in the sky. From their town the lonely mountain was mostly screened by the low hills at the far end of the lake, through a gap in which the running river came down from the north. Only its high peak could they see in clear weather, and they seldom looked at it, for it was ominous and drear, even in the light of morning. Now it was lost and gone, blotted in the dark. Suddenly it flickered back to view. A brief glow touched it and faded. "Look," said one, "the lights again. Last night the watchman saw them start and fade from midnight until dawn. Something's happening up there. Perhaps the king under the mountain is forging gold," said another. "It's long since he went north. It is time the songs began to prove themselves again." "Which king?" said another with a grim voice. "As like as not it is the marauding father of the dragon, the only king under the mountain we've ever known." "You're always foreboding gloomy things," said the others. "Anything from floods to poisoned fish. Think of something cheerful." Then suddenly a great light appeared in the low place in the hills, and the northern end of the lake turned golden. "The king beneath the mountain," they shouted. "His wealth is like the sun, his silver like a fountain, his rivers golden run. The river is running gold from the mountain," they cried, and everywhere windows were opened and feet were hurrying. There was once more a tremendous excitement and enthusiasm, but the grim-voiced fellow ran hot-foot to the master. "The dragon is coming, or I'm a fool," he cried. "Cut the bridges. To arms! To arms!" Then warning trumpets were suddenly sounded, and echoed along the rocky shores. The cheering stopped, and the joy was turned to dread. So it was that the dragon did not find them quite unprepared. Before long, so great was his speed, they could see him as a spark of fire rushing towards them and growing ever huger and more bright, and not the most foolish doubted that the prophecies had gone rather wrong. Still, they had a little time. Every vessel in the town was filled with water. Every warrior was armed. Every arrow and dart was ready, and the bridge to the land was thrown down and destroyed, before the roar of Smaug's terrible approach grew loud, and the lake rippled red as fire beneath the awful beating of his wings. Amid shrieks and wailing and the shouts of men, he came over them, swept towards the bridges, and was foiled. The bridge was gone, and his enemies were on an island in deep water, too deep and dark and cool for his liking. If he plunged into it, a vapor and a steam would arise enough to cover all the land with a mist for days.
but the lake was mightier than he. It would quench him before he could pass through. Roaring, he swept back over the town. A hail of dark arrows leapt up and snapped and rattled on his scales and jewels, and their shafts fell back, kindled by his breath burning and hissing into the lake. No fireworks you ever imagined equaled the sights that night. At the twanging of the bows and the shrilling of the trumpets, the dragon's wrath blazed to its height, till he was blind and mad with it. No one had dared to give battle to him for many an age, nor would they have dared now, if it had not been for the grim-voiced man, Bard was his name, who ran to and fro cheering on the archers and urging the master to order them to fight to the last arrow. Fire leapt from the dragon's jaws. He circled for a while high in the air above them, lighting all the lake. The trees by the shores shone like copper and like blood, with leaping shadows of dense black at their feet. Then down he swooped straight through the arrow storm, reckless in his rage, taking no heed to turn his scaly sides towards his foes, seeking only to set their town ablaze. Fire leapt from thatched roofs and wooden beam ends as he hurtled down and past and round again, though all had been drenched with water before he came. Once more water was flung by 100 hands wherever a spark appeared. Back swirled the dragon. A sweep of his tail, and the roof of the great house crumbled and smashed down. Flames unquenchable sprang high into the night. Another swoop, and another house, and then another sprang afire and fell, and still no arrow hindered Smaug, or hurt him more than a fly from the marshes. Already men were jumping into the water on every side. Women and children were being huddled into laden boats in the market pool. Weapons were flung down. There was mourning and weeping, where but a little time ago the old songs of mirth to come had been sung about the dwarves. Now men cursed their names. The master himself was turning to his great gilded boat, hoping to row away in the confusion and save himself. Soon all the town would be deserted and burned down to the surface of the lake. That was the dragon's hope. They could all get into boats for all he cared. There he could have fine sport hunting them, or they could stop till they starved. Let them try to get to land, and he would be ready. Soon he would set all the shore and woods ablaze and wither every field and pasture. Just now he was enjoying the sport of town-baiting more than he had enjoyed anything for years. But there was still a company of archers that held their ground among the burning houses. Their captain was Bard, grim-voiced and grim-faced, whose friends had accused him of prophesying floods and poisoned fish, though they knew his worth and courage. He was a descendant in long line of Geryon, Lord of Dale, whose wife and child had escaped down the running river from the ruin long ago. Now he shot with a great yew bow, till all his arrows but one were spent. The flames were near him. His companions were leaving him. He bent his bow for the last time. Suddenly out of the dark something fluttered to his shoulder. He started, but it was only an old thrush. Unafraid, it perched by his ear, and it brought him news. Marveling, he found he could understand its tongue, for he was of the race of Dale.
"Wait, wait," it said to him. "The moon is rising. Look for the hollow of the left breast as he flies and turns above you."
And while Bard paused in wonder, it told him of tidings up in the mountain and of all that it had heard. Then Bard drew his bowstring to his ear. The dragon was circling back, flying low, and as he came, the moon rose above the eastern shore and silvered his great wings.
"Arrow," said the bowman, "Black Arrow, I have saved you to the last. You have never failed me,
and always I have recovered you. I had you from my father, and he from of old. If ever you came from the forges of the true king under the mountain, go now and speed well.